You also understand that you'll be required to work long, hard hours, sometimes deep into the night.
It'll be a pleasure to work under you.
Still Queer as Folk.
You're listening to the Still Queer as Folk podcast, where each week we take down an episode of Showtime's Queer as Folk TV show to find out if it still holds up 15 years later. I'm Patrick Randall.
And I'm Matt Dominguez.
Please click that subscribe button so you don't miss any of our episodes. And if you like the show, we love 5-star ratings.
Continue our discussion with us on all of the social media platforms, including Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Our handles are Still Queer AF.
This episode is called Hunt for Love. It's episode 8 of season 3.
Are we going to say it as Hunt for Love?
Well, that's how it's spelled. It's H-U-N-T parenthesis E-R parenthesis.
Okay, so we're just going to make sure we emphasize the er.
Hunt for Love.
It first aired in the U.S. on April 27th,
2003. Hunt for Love was directed by Bruce MacDonald, my favorite director.
It was the reason why I liked this episode.
There's only two more Bruce MacDonald episodes, though, after this one. Mm-hmm. I'm really sad about that.
I'm sorry, Patrick. Mm. Ron Cohen and Daniel Lipman, executive producers, wrote the story, and Ephraim Seeger wrote the teleplay. We talked about Ephraim Seeger in episode 3 of this season, if you want to learn more about his credits.
Here's what happened in Hunt for Love from Queer as Folk, the book.
With Liberty Avenue being cleaned up, the hustlers are moving to other neighborhoods, namely Michael and Ben's. But the professor takes pity on one of the youngest callboys.
Don't they live like right off Liberty Avenue? So, what is this new neighborhood that the hustlers moved to?
It's like they just want a block over.
Yeah, they went onto the side street. Justin moves in with Daphne and resumes pursuing Brian.
Lindsay goes to work at an art gallery and hires Emmett to throw a party for a show opening.
The night is a huge success, but Ted can't be happy for his guy when a bad back and general feeling of worthlessness settles in.
I'm right there with you on that.
You know, something I found out that I never really realized is that Queer as Folk, the book, which we're calling the Bible, ends at season 3. So
we're going to be on our own for the remaining 2 seasons.
Yeah. So I think we might have to go back to TVDB, and hopefully some people have written some better synopsis that we can use. So we meet a new character in this episode, Hunter.
I'm very excited.
That's the only part of his name that we know at this point. This sort of felt like when Cousin Oliver showed up on the Brady Bunch for that last season. You're not a Brady Bunch fan?
I watched the like 90s movies.
Oh, those are good too.
Yes.
So in the final season of the Brady Bunch, all the Brady kids had grown up and they wanted a cute, cuddly youngster in there. So
to make it relatable again.
Yeah. So Cousin Oliver comes in and he just sort of wrecked the show. So amongst Brady Bunch aficionados, the moment that Oliver first shows up in the show, that's when it jumps the shark.
That's when everyone's like, I'm out. Click.
And I kind of think that's sort of the same way with Hunter
really?
Showing up okay. in this show. Harris Allen plays Hunter. We have some interesting things to share about Harris Allen as we get deeper into this season.
I looked at his IMDb page and looked at his current headshot, and he has aged.
He's a rapper.
Very well.
He put out a rap album.
I'm going to go ahead and retract my statement then.
He kind of looks like a well-groomed Charlie Hunnam, who played Nathan in the original Queer as Folk.
And then turned into, what's his name, Jax from Sons of Anarchy?
The real badass.
Like, he buffed out. Ooh.
He was really good in that movie, Pacific Rim. No pun intended.
Not that kind of rim.
So in Hunter for Love, I put the A story as Justin and Brian. There was a great music intro in this scene where Justin is moping around Daphne's apartment. It was a song called Loretta Young Silks by the Sneaker Pimps. This is the second time Scott McFadden and Michael Perlmutter have used Sneaker Pimps songs in this show. So I really, really like that. Season 1, episode 19 had Spin Spin Sugar playing at Babylon in a back room scene. It just makes me long for the days when gays liked real music. Not like Troye Sivan.
You're still on this Troye Sivan kick.
Yes, because he played in Chicago recently,
yes,
sold out a great big theater.
Chicago theater.
And everybody, all the gays just went batshit crazy for this.
All the young gays.
And I saw all the Snapchats from it, all the Instagram stories. Troye Sivan is awful. On stage, he has no stage presence.
Well, I'm curious to know what you're going to think if you see the movie Boy Erased. Because he's in that. He acts.
Oh, I thought he was cute when he was doing YouTube videos and like coming out. But after that, it's he's like one of the monkeys where he's like invented him.
Yeah, I guess so.
Yeah, it's like I talked about last time. He has marginal talent. He has good producers that are writing music for him. He writes terrible and stupid sophomoric lyrics. And then he just kind of swishes around stage and wiggles. And everybody's like, like fainting, passing out. Oh, it drives me crazy. He's a robot. Okay.
So I shouldn't. So Justin, as we last left Justin in, I guess, Daphne's apartment where he is crashing. And I love how you use the phrase moping. I think that is 1,000% the way to describe it. He's like smoking a cigarette and forlornly thinking about his life. And
just, he's in these like little cotton harem pants.
Nice. Yes, just longing for the days that could be in his man's arms. And I love when Daphne shows up and she is trying to say, hey, you should try and get over him.
It's only natural that these things take time. You know, you gotta somehow get over him. Move on. Tell yourself Ethan's history.
Who's talking about Ethan? I'm talking about Brian.
Brian? I thought you were over him. That's what you said.
I thought I was, too. So what do you do when you realize you made the biggest fucking mistake of your pathetic, stupid life?
I bumped on this one. He did such a quick U-turn back to Brian after Ethan peaced out. That was only like one episode ago.
Right. He says he made a mistake because it didn't work out with Ethan. And so this switch doesn't really track for me.
He went way beyond like, I made a mistake. I'm just unsure why he sees Brian as the biggest fucking mistake of his pathetic, stupid life. Like, where does this come from? It's like serious rap on Ethan. Brian.
It's as if the writers were like, okay, we need to Ross and Rachel this really quickly. So let's make sure that we say that Justin realized he made the biggest fucking mistake by going with Ethan and leaving Brian, and he has to do everything in his power to get Brian back. But so you're going to tell me that now that Ethan is out of the picture because of the cheating scandal, that Justin is now realizing that the whole thing was just this fantasy and now he's broken out of the
drama
fantasy?
Queen.
Listen, queen, we'd all take it down a notch.
This really should have been the moment when Brian needed to win him back, not Justin win back Brian.
Exactly.
Because Justin was holding all the cards here.
And it should have been up to Brian to be like, oh, you know what? This is my chance. Now that Ethan is gone for making his dumb mistake, Justin will realize that I was always 100% with him and I will get him.
The thing,
why is Justin doing the work?
The thing about the writing that I thought was so awful here is that it didn't show any growth in the Justin character.
Yeah, he just literally falls right back to where he was.
Yeah, and then some. fell back to like the beginning of season 2. Possibly season 1.
Where he just woke up next to him and he thinks he's going to be in love with him forever because he was the first person that fucked me.
Yeah, instead now he's dreaming about levitating and getting fucked in midair. It's like, this writing was awful. I couldn't believe it.
And again, Daphne is shown as being the level-headed person going like, really?
There was something about this scene that I really like though. I was so excited to see the inside of Daphne's apartment.
Let's know how Daphne lives.
There was some really interesting set dressing here. She has a poster of Subway Series on her wall, and that was a graphic novel by Leela Korman in 2002. Let me read the synopsis of that series. Subway Series follows the exploits of Tina, a frustrated 16-year-old city girl whose affections are divided between two guys. The problem is, one has an out-of-town girlfriend, and the other is a complete jerk. Add to that, a bitchy adversary whom she once called a friend, who's out to humiliate her. And now confused Tina doesn't know which way to turn. That's on Daphne's wall. She loves this series. So I love thinking about how that comic must have really resonated with Daphne.
That is a fantastic detail that I think it's amazing. Because we've always commented how the various set dressing or prop work in this show has managed to somehow maintain continuity when the main storyline usually doesn't.
Mm-hmm.
So the fact that they've managed to find people who are like, well, you know what? Let's harken back to this, or let's respond to this, or make a comment on this using these pieces. That's such a great detail that I wish like the rest of the show could offer.
I feel like we need a Daphne spinoff after seeing the inside of her apartment.
Yes, and it's just called Daphne with an exclamation point.
Yeah, let's write that.
I'm into
it. Let's do some fanfic.
Right.
There was a mistake in this episode, though. Daphne made a reference to one Billy Hauser that she had a crush on and basically stalked him everywhere, including to swim practice. But the swimmer that Daphne dated in season one was named Glenn Reeves.
She could have dated Billy more Hauser. Than one.
Well, yes. Do you think that she is a swim fan?
100% yes. I mean, have you seen swimmers' bodies? Because yes.
Did you see the movie Swim Fan?
Yes, I have.
I think that's Daphne.
Well, that's terrifying.
We do get to see Brian doing ad man shit.
Ad man.
Where the fuck's the layout for Mighty Mints? Oh, I know. I promised that to you this morning. Any way I can help speed things up? Salary cut? Pink slip? You'll have it by noon. And starting today, things should go a little faster. We're hiring a new student intern to help with the busy work. Brian, this is Justin Taylor, our new intern. Justin, this is Mr. Kinney, one of the partners in the agency. Nice to meet you, Mr. Kinney.
Of all the ad agencies in this city, he had to walk into mine.
Well, Justin came up with a great way to wiggle back into Brian's life. The dialogue in this scene, though, was some top-notch writing. So as much as I was complaining about the overall story arc, the way that Brian and Justin were working back and forth was really mm-hmm. good, snappy dialogue by Ephraim Seeger.
Yes, it was playful, and I think it finally showed—
Double entendre.
Yes, it showed me the chemistry that I think a lot of our listeners have always seen between Brian and Justin that I thought was really apparent with Ethan and Justin. Here, I'm like, oh, here's where I see the playfulness between the two of them, where I can see them toying with each other and actually flirting, and I'm seeing the sparks come out here. I was really enjoying the way the dialogue was written in this. But then I had a question about this. Had Justin never even shown his face around the office? Was no one actually aware of who Justin was?
Cynthia knows him, definitely.
Does she? Because I was thinking about this. I was like, who do we know who were tied to Justin that would know or that had been in the office? I can only think of
Emmett
Jennifer.
Emmett had been in the office.
Well, I'm thinking of Jennifer when she came in to his and stormed in. Is like, great, he's your problem now. Dropped his bags in front of him and said, this is all the things you need to worry about now that Justin is living with you. But then I was thinking back. I was like, was there a moment where Justin was ever spotted? No one knew who Justin was?
You know, that's interesting that you point that out because later in the season, Gardner Vance doesn't know the significance of Justin. Gardner only knows Justin as the intern. He doesn't find out until mm-hmm. much later what Justin really is to Brian.
Oh, okay.
A little bit of foreshadowing
but
there.
But I guess that's an interesting little thing. It's a little nugget of information that I'm shocked and I like was thinking about that is that, yeah, I guess no one who, that's such a smart little ploy that Justin has. He's like, no one would know who I am except for Brian.
Maybe the firm is just so gigantic that there's just tons of people there. And y'all work in the same company. You just don't know everybody.
Well, and then again, the last time Jennifer was there was before the takeover. And all those people are gone except for Brian and like his assistant, Cynthia. So, yeah, I guess it does help that no one knows who Justin is. They're all gone. Who might have known?
There's a moment later where Brian says,
the ubiquitous Justin Taylor. Fancy meeting you here. Fancy that.
That was sort of recycling season one stories where Justin is pursuing Brian and Brian is rebuffing him.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought that was, again, we've seen this several times in season three where things that have happened before in the show happen again.
Yeah, because it's the same with the repeats of this of the Dr. David Cameron line coming up between mm-hmm. Ted and Emmett. Yeah, I don't know why they decided to take like, well, we put these characters in this storyline. Let's go ahead and put these characters in the storyline and see what happens.
Well, it's almost like the writers from season three did not participate in seasons one and two, nor did they watch them. They just sat down and had a blank slate and start writing for these characters.
They walk into the writer's room and is like, okay, so here's my idea.
There's a little blonde twink.
And stay with me on here. What I'm envisioning, I'm like, No, we did this. We did this. There was actually like a 4-episode story arc tied to this. No.
Yeah, doesn't ring a bell
at all. No one thought to like maybe rent the VHS or something. I don't know. Nothing.
Possibly read the scripts or
anything.
Get the tone right.
You would think Cohen and Lippman would have been like, well, we sort of already did this. No. They're like, put it on paper. Who cares? Can we talk about, I'm glad to know that this was a Bruce McDonald episode because
he saved it.
Well, because I started noticing the shot details that I don't think I've ever seen before in the series. And one particular one was in the conversation that Brian and Justin have in Brian's office, where the camera sort of frames both Brian and Justin when it cuts back and forth between them, where they are put like in the lower corner. And the camera slowly pushes in on them as it cuts back and forth between their discussion. And it was something very different I hadn't really seen in the series
before.
Yeah,
that's a Bruce McDonald style that I've talked about a few times where it's very unexpected and it's delightful. It's nice to see some creativity versus like a single camera shoot on a 30-minute sitcom.
Yeah, and I think it helped. It helps support that back and forth that we were seeing in the dialogue, and to see them push in, it really helped literally drive the action. And like, it pulled me in as the camera pushed in. It was thought a very smart camera work.
There's something I didn't like about work the next day. Brian comes into the art room where Justin's the only one working. Justin, of course, says, "Hey, Brian." Mm-hmm. Then Brian says, "It's Mr. Kinney."
Yes, Daddy.
Well, that's old man writing again. I have commented on this a few times about how the boss figures in Queer as Folk are always referred to as Mr. or Mrs. or Ms. or something like that. It just doesn't make sense because nobody addresses their boss that way these days or those days.
I think it, maybe this is too subtle and maybe this is just me trying to interpret it, but it almost read like a little bit of a dominant submissive play. Hey, Brian, Mr. Kinney.
I would have thought that if it wasn't for having seen this in many other episodes before.
Sure.
Where it didn't have that connotation. So it always just strikes me when there's unrealistic dialogue, and I always bump on that.
Well, and this show is chock full of that.
Oh, yeah.
But at least in this episode, I was thinking about it as I kept watching. I was like, this dialogue is just popping back and forth, and I'm very into it. I mean, overall, I really enjoyed this episode, but it was in particular these moments between Brian and Justin where they just were on fire.
I liked how Justin was flattering Brian with talk about how the workplace culture starts at the top and works its way down and how everyone is so nice and smart there. But is there anything at all about Brian Kinney that would ever make you think that he would be a great boss?
God, no.
Exactly.
He's a terrible boss. He's demeaning to all of his subordinates.
He fucks some of them.
Wait, Kip. Did he actually fuck any of his employees?
He fucked Kip.
Oh, yeah, he did.
On his desk.
Yeah, that's right.
It was the best thing to come on his desk in a long time. Sorry, come across his desk.
Ooh. Well, let's be honest, he probably came on his desk too.
Why did Brian fire Justin after that client meeting, though?
Your job was to put up the boards, which you could barely do, and keep your mouth shut.
I'm sorry. Won't happen again.
You're damn right it won't. You're through. Are you firing me? You wanted on the job experience, right? Lesson one, you fuck up, you're gone.
But you got the account.
And she got my balls, thanks to you.
Brian.
Mr. Kinney,
I would appreciate it if you'd give me a second chance.
Never should have given you the first one out. Pack up your shit and go home.
Oh, that was such an ego trip. Justin sort of lets slip an idea that helps them land the account. But because Brian didn't win the account, he's going to fire Justin for speaking up?
Yeah, so I wondered if this was to get rid of Justin or, like as you said, to assert some kind of a dominance role and make him have to beg. So I'm just not sure which one it was there, though.
But I feel like if Gardner Vance had gotten word that Brian fired this intern that helped them land this massive account, what would that conversation have been like? Because I can't remember how much of the business does Brian actually own as a partner?
Yeah, we never really know.
because I still feel like Gardner Vance is his boss. Like Brian still has to answer to him.
Yeah, we do find out that Gardner's the majority shareholder. So we know that Brian has a minority stake in the business, but We're never like real sure like what his standing is there.
So yeah, he lets Justin go because Justin seemed to be on top of what the art world is talking about today. I'm sorry. I feel like if an intern was like, well, this might be a good idea, and then we see that the client goes for it, great. I want to know more about this kid's ideas. And I think it had to have been that the client's comment about, be careful, this kid might be after your job.
Yeah, I would just think.
It was just
Brian is the type lazy. Of person that would take credit for anybody's good idea, though. And he said that before. Mm-hmm. So he said that to Kip.
After he fucked him.
Maybe before.
While.
So there's another thing that I bumped on here in the story. It's like the writing was good. But again, when Justin is trying to keep his position and he keeps thinking of his relationship with Ethan as the biggest fucking mistake of his life and that he would live to regret it. What was Brian giving him that was a million times better? I don't know what.
I don't know.
It was good dialogue if it was in a vacuum. If we hadn't had 10 episodes of the seduction of Ethan Gold, violinist extraordinaire.
Oh, with the wine and the roses and the cheese and the bohemian loft. I mean. Yeah.
I like that Justin had some real balls there and he just gave him the tongue right in the art room there. Mm.
And then he walks away. Oh, yeah.
I did like the look on Brian's face. And, you know, Brian pretty much challenges him.
Go for it. And, he did.
And then Brian looks stunned. He was a little bit, I don't know how to feel about this, but I liked it. But wait a minute. I'm Mr. Kinney. Oh, wait, get out of here. You're fired.
Blah. I would like to think that this whole thing was clearly orchestrated by Justin. He knows Brian that well.
I would like to think so, but at the same time, that just wasn't conveyed to us.
Mm-hmm. It's a lot of inner life that I'm trying to project onto what I saw. That I don't think there was actually, like, that was what the writers were totally planning.
The Brian and Justin makeup fuck is one of my favorite scenes in the entire series.
It was rather gorgeous.
I gave it some thought. I decided you should take me back.
Oh?
Even though I have made a few mistakes, I think you'd be making an even bigger one not to give me a second chance.
I see.
Because now I understand what it is you want of me. And I know what I can expect from you.
You also understand that you'll be required to work long, hard hours, sometimes deep into the night.
It'll be a pleasure to work under you, sir.
And you're never to play violin music in my presence again. Well, then, you can start immediately.
There was something about filming it in a way that it felt like we were observers. But we were not.
Yeah, it was viewed through the prisms of Brian's office glass. So there's speed changes, there's out of sequence shots where, like, their clothes are on, then they're off, then we see it in a different perspective. We're first person, we're second person. It is nice.
It doesn't feel as, and you know, as I mentioned in a lot of the previous sex scenes between the two of them, it didn't feel mechanical. It felt passionate. It felt like it was on fire. Like, oh, this is what these two feel for each other. And it's because they toned down the more explicit nature of it. It felt more lovely, like more tender in a way.
Yeah.
And thus more believable that these are two men who are actually falling for each other.
It was really directed and cut together well, and Lisa Grutenbohr edited the episode. She went on to cut major shows like The Borgias and The Tudors, as well as 39 episodes of Queer as Folk. So in a lot of cases, the editor has an awful lot of input in the way that a scene comes together, and I think her pairing with Bruce McDonald here was outstanding in this scene. The music that was playing underneath it was a song called Lover's Spit by Broken Social Scene. They're a pretty big group. They're Canadian, and there's, I don't know, like 20 different collaborators in the group. I have maybe 4 of their records.
Oh.
Really, really like that song.
Still queer as folk.
Like what you hear? Be sure to subscribe and rate us on iTunes. We like those 5 stars.
Still Queer as Folk. There's more on the way. Pittsburgh has an awful lot of streetwalking gay prostitutes, apparently.
It must be, like, gay for pay.
Well, that dated the show pretty quickly, because these days I think the rent boy market is 100% digital.
Absolutely.
Except for an occasional stray wandering, like, around Boys Town.
Well, and it's
looking
very,
for somebody that appears lonely.
It's very funny you mentioned Boys Town, because the one time I have been propositioned while walking in Boys Town was not by a man.
A boy?
And not by a boy. by
a woman.
What I believe to be a woman. And I wanted to be, oh, honey, you're working the wrong corner. I was like, Boys Town.
There might be
a
strategy to that where there's the ambiguously straight people that go out in Boys Town. And then they're like, oh, I can't. And then they walk out and they're like, female.
You, $20. Yes. No.
Well, speaking of $20, I guess it costs $100 to suck off Hunter.
How you doing?
How old are you?
How old do you want me to be?
You can't be more than 16.
You like young dick? You could suck it for a bill. For two, you could fuck me. Without a condom.
That seems pretty pricey to me.
Maybe this is why the other hustlers really didn't like him.
Because he charges top dollar?
Because he thinks he's worth top dollar. But yeah, he says a bill you can suck, and then two, you can fuck me without a condom.
Okay, so $200 to fuck. Yeah, that sounds about right. $100 for a blowjob, though, just seems really expensive.
Because it's going to be, like, what, 10 minutes of your time? Because, like, these are people that are, they are picking these people up in their car, driving off to some right. alleyway, getting off, and then spinning them around to drop them off in front of his corner again.
It's much easier just to grab the mailman and get one for free.
Exactly. Delivery. I find it very... And I'm with Ben on this. He finds the whole one, the offer, incredulous that Hunter is saying you can fuck him for $200 without a condom. But also the fact that it's because of Stockwell's policies that have pushed the hustlers out of Liberty Avenue.
Around the corner.
We're assuming like a block and a half. To then loudly hustle in front of an apartment building.
Hey, I got a nice tight ass, Daddy. You want a nice tight ass? You want to fuck me?
Hey, you
fuck
can do my friend and me for the price of one. Come on, what do you say?
You like young dick? You could suck me for $50.
Yeah, and it was such a
background soundtrack.
Well, and it was such an interesting way to introduce us to the hustler problem. You know, a lot of it was all like direct address to the camera as if we're the client, and how hard these hustlers are trying to work for that dollar. But
$100.
Excuse me. Yes, $100. But again, yeah, Ben is just like, No. And he just gets back into his apartment, but he can't shake Hunter from his mind because of how young he is.
I did like that Hunter, as he was being shot in the introductory scene, it's a black and white scene, and Hunter has the only bit of color in there, and he has like a red stocking hat on. Mm-hmm. I did like that. That was the call out to this is Hunter. We don't know who he is just yet. We just know that this character is important. There's a little bit of bad writing the next morning when Michael is trying to talk to Ben and Ben has earplugs in. That was just stupid. It was just such a dumb gag. It's like, oh, I forgot. I have foam in my ears. I like woke up. I made breakfast. I took a shower. I got ready. Totally forgot these earplugs were in until Michael like whacks me upside the head.
Well, in which Michael points out, he's like, oh, I just thought you were deep in thought or something. I was like,
So this episode is a really mixed bag of like outstanding writing and just.
And then some clunkers. Yeah. For sure. But they run and they come out in the hall and they see Hunter passed out, basically.
This was good writing.
Basically, yeah, he basically passed out on the stairwell. He's just sleeping.
Michael's like kicking him. He's like, is he dead?
He doesn't kick
him.
He
takes his pulse.
He doesn't quite kick him. He sort of just nudges at him. But I think Michael is, I understand his thinking here. He's being cautious because, yeah, this is a hustler who will do anything for money. He may be young, but he clearly is trying to survive on the streets by any means necessary. You don't know what he's capable of.
Yeah, I did like that Ben took pity on him, though.
Oh, I loved that, too. And I think Michael is harsh, but I do see his side of it, though. And it therefore gives this storyline some legitimate conflict between Michael and Ben.
Yeah, Hunter becomes sort of like an emotional support twink.
Mm-hmm. I do, and I love what Hunter says. He says that he's offering 2-for-1 discounts, and Michael claps back with, "What? What are you, Q-Mart?"
Oh yeah, there's a call out to the Q-Mart that we hadn't heard of since early season 2.
Yeah, and I was like, "Is that triggering for you, Michael?"
Of course, when you find a young hustler in your hallway, where do you take him? To the diner. Of course. There's a great, great, great prop moment here when Hunter is eating that burger. He took a bite and steam came off of it.
Mm.
Because there's nothing I hate worse than seeing a lack of detail with props, like drinking coffee from an empty cup.
Yes, there's no weight.
Yeah, so this was heads up work because it was a tight shot on Hunter's face. Right as he's eating, he was starving. That food had to be real. And they heated it up. They heated it up for the shot. They probably had to do the shot half a dozen times. That prop person was heating that up every time and making sure that he had a steam coming out of his burger. It's great.
I mean, it definitely worked because I was getting hungry watching that. It's like that milkshake looks good. That burger looks good. I'm here for it.
Hunter sure does have terrible table manners, though. He's like eating with his hands and like, yeah.
I was just like, oh, okay, I wasn't a big fan. Like, yeah, the sound detail, the sound mixing of that detail, the Foley work was very specific. And it was like, where it's like, this is just gross enough that I don't like watching you eat.
Later that night, Ben breaks up the hustler street fight, like single-handedly, while Michael is standing on the sidewalk hollering at him and shrieking.
I think he has some residual steroids in him, so he's able to just pick people up and toss them as he goes.
In this episode, so many times, I kept thinking that Michael is just a really bad person. He's like, stay away from them. Don't get involved. It's not our problem. Get out of here. It's like, oh, Poochie, gee, mommy, can I keep him? And it's like,
I mean, yes.
They
I
just turned up like the Michael meanness a little too much.
And Ben points it out and saying, have you no compassion? But because Michael has never been really a subtle character because he still has the mental capacity of, I think, a teenager. I understand why he's cautious, why he's nervous, because again, because there's that moment in the diner where Hunter grabbed
he took a knife.
He took a knife. He took one of the butter knives in a roll and walked out. And I'm like, what is he going to use that knife for?
To put butter on his roll.
As he walks out? He didn't take, I didn't see any butter.
That, I think that was meant to give him an edge because later Michael says, they could have had a knife. It's like, back off. I'm going to butter you right now.
Mm. You can butter Hunter for $200.
Well, speaking of buttering Hunter, they got the twink naked. You know, he came out of the shower.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, Ben invites the naked twink to spend the night. So I thought that was a little bit of a gratuitous nudity moment that didn't really need to be there.
Well, it was just a slight ass shot.
Yeah, but I don't know. Why did that need to be there? What?
I don't know. You would have expected like Ben to want to like help cover him up or something like that. Because all Hunter
Here's
is doing.
Here's my robe.
Right. All Hunter is doing is presenting to say, hey, who wants to go first?
Oh, yeah. Well, maybe that was it then. Maybe that's why he came out naked. Like, well, okay, I'm ready.
That's what he says. He said, who am I going to fuck first? Or who's going to fuck me first?
So after being released back out into the wild. It didn't take long for him to get picked up by a John, I guess we call them.
Yes.
As Ben's watching out the window, and that's really it for the Hunter story. So it's a nice intro of a new character that I don't think needed to be in the show.
it's what bonds Ben and Michael together. But I also found it a very deliberate choice to have the sound so amped up of the hustlers on the street below as Michael is trying to get Ben to sit and have dinner, really helps sell the point that Ben is worrying. He's now worried for this kid because for all we know, this kid's going to go meet a John and we're not going to see him ever again. So to have it
that wouldn't have been the worst thing for this show.
Really amped. Okay. So you have feelings about Hunter apparently.
He's the Oliver of the show.
To have the sound so deliberately pumped in, because it's like, otherwise the insulation in this apartment building sucks.
Yeah.
So that's
it's like they had the windows wide open or something.
Yes. They're like, I'm sorry, if you close the windows, I'm pretty sure it'll be a lot quieter than you think it is. So I think it was a very deliberate choice to help sort of surround Ben in all that noise so that it's going to constantly nag at him about where Hunter may be.
Still queer as folk.
So we find out that Lindsay is back to work.
Selling art.
So finally, there's some decent dyke writing here.
I was very excited for this story.
So once again, this episode is kind of all over the place with the writing. This story made sense to me for once. The dyke story. Lindsay needs to get back to work because Melanie is going to go on leave at some point in the next 9 months. Mm-hmm. So they kind of need to swap roles. And there's a nice treatment of her having to leave Gus for the first time. Something I noticed is that Melanie quotes Gone with the Wind.
Oh, I'm going to miss you, pumpkin. Mama. I'm going to think about you all day, lambskin.
This is the greatest goodbye since Rhett and Scarlet.
I can't help it. I've been with him practically every moment since he's been born.
So I think it's interesting the way that the Queer as Folk writers are always quoting either super obscure movies and theater, or it's something entirely obvious that makes it just sound cheap. The like greatest goodbye obvious. Since Rhett and Scarlet. It's like,
well, there's another one that I think is a lot more subtle than you that I'll get to when we talk about Ted and Emmett. Yeah, and I love the fact that Lindsay is sort of being that worried parent. She makes a great point about, you know, I've been with him since the day he was born.
And yeah, except that time she went to that teacher conference and left him with Brian, and Brian went to the leather ball.
Yes, that one time.
And or the time that Justin babysat him.
Yes, and she's trying to find all these different excuses. Like, she's like, oh, I should change my outfit. I should change this. I should do this. I should do that. Just to try and still be within range of Gus. But hey, she gets to her first day of work at the gallery, and she sells a painting to someone who has been going there for 10 years.
That rang a little false to me, though.
It's like, is she really that good?
Well, yeah. I mean, how long can you really go to a gallery without buying something? You know?
Yeah, it's like, that had to be an exaggeration, enough, right?
Right, so sloppy writing there, but I get the point. I just love seeing Lindsay bringing this art history dialogue to her job.
Yes. Boom with the reference. Here's another one. Here's another.
Yeah. She had intelligent lines. The lesbians rarely get those from Queer as Folk writers.
They rarely get any type of focus where it's believable, intelligent, complex dialogue to help sell who this person is as a character.
Lindsay sure was asserting herself at that gallery, though, on her second day. You know, she fires the party planner.
With Florinda. No, we have to talk more about Florinda.
Then you can deal with Florinda Zeckendorf, formerly Hitler's mistress, currently planning our opening. She'll be storming in here tomorrow to discuss the final details. I'm sure if anyone can withstand the assault of a Panzer division single-handed, it's you. Enjoy.
One, I felt like there were a lot of Hitler references.
Oh, yeah, I noticed that too.
With Florinda. I was like, whoa, wait a minute. I mean, you're talking about Panzer Defense and things like that. I was like,
she reminded me a little of Frau Farbissina from the Austin Powers series. <Yeah. laughs> From the militant wing of the LPGA.
Yes, she has the very close, severe haircut with the scarf on the neck. And she's saying, like, as usual, we'll do the finger sandwiches. We'll do this. We'll do that. As if she keeps calling the owner of the gallery Sydney. Of course, his name is Sydney.
Mr. Bloom.
She tried. And I could tell you, though, I could watch that Florinda versus Lindsay scene for days. I got such a kick out of it.
I just found it. I was going to say I found it disturbing that she just kind of walks in, and she didn't even go through orientation at that point. She's just firing people.
Well, she said, presumptuous. Like, he put me in charge of it.
Yeah.
Well, and even when she said, when she told Florida that she was fired, you could tell that she's like, I am feeling kind of emboldened to do this. You're fired. She was like trying to show that she can go. She's not intimidated by her, that she can go toe to toe with her. So that's why she was feeding her these ideas. She's like, well, I should go to Sydney with this. Like, if she had the hair, Florinda would have hair tossed.
And while I'm at it, I'll tell him that his office girl should be answering phones and taking messages, not interfering with the work of highly respected professionals.
Well, you needn't bother telling him anything, Ms. Zeckendorf, because you're fired.
You can't fire me. I've known Sidney for years. His ex-wife and I are like this.
I will say, I think I found it very easy to be like, well, Sidney just didn't have the nerve to want to fire her. What? You run this gallery. We see later on in this storyline that he can be kind of a prick.
So he was like, ready to fire Lindsay.
Yeah, he was all ready to fire Lindsay for hiring Emmett as a replacement who was going to bring in drag queens.
Oh, well, first let's talk about this great Bruce McDonald shot when Lindsay called Emmett.
Yes.
They were in the same room.
I thought that was so clever. He answers the phone and she answers and just turns into the shot too. I was like, oh, that's fun.
Yeah, it was nice that the focus was just pulling back and forth between them. And that takes some thought, and it was really quick also, but it's a really great Bruce McDonald touch.
Yeah, it's a very clever thing to give you a new look, and I really, really enjoyed to just have that one little detail in it. It was really fantastic.
I love these drag queens that showed up. Drag queens.
Drag.
I liked how sassy they were when Sydney was, before they were like serving the party. And
oh, my favorite one is, you can hear it. Oh, I love a man who's forceful.
Get out of my way.
Oh, I love a man who's forceful.
Testy, isn't he?
Oh, God, and please tell me everything's going to be all right and I have nothing to worry about.
Great background dialogue.
Yeah, you could hear like, God, when are we going to get started? How long do we have to be here? Like, you could just hear them just back and forth. And I'm sorry, like, it's funny. Drag queens today, oh my God, they would have sold that event.
Well, the funny thing was, for the casting call, they didn't really come in costume that they were going to be in for the actual party. I thought that was unusual. If you're a drag queen and you're showing up to be cast for something, you go in drag.
I was going to say, yeah, it was sort of a mix and match.
They were like in street drag or something.
Yeah, they were in day drag.
Is that what it's called?
Yeah, day drag is totally a thing.
I loved how they got all night dragged up.
Yes, for the because it's French impressionist paintings.
Yeah, that party was great. I would go to that party.
It was beautiful. I mean, it was lively. It was fun. They were feeding Sydney. I mean,
the guy that bought the painting was there.
Yeah, he was eyeing all the drag queens. Yeah. They were having, oh my, yeah, it looked like such a blast.
This was a nice few moments with Lindsay and Melanie. And I'm glad that it was in this episode. Again, we have notes on this.
Yes.
But it was nice. Yeah. I was there.
Still queer as folk.
So Ted comes back into the gym and Michael says that he hasn't seen him in weeks. Where the hell has he been?
I mean, was he trying to continue to keep a low profile even though his case was basically handled? Like, what?
Once, yeah, he you comes commented in the last episode that we have like no concept of time in this
zero.
Show.
Zero. Absolutely.
And I thought about that and realized that the prop supervisor in this show is always setting the clocks right. So when somebody comes home from work, it's like between 6 and 7 o'clock. When they're getting ready to go to work, it's like 8 o'clock in the morning.
These props masters are the ones that are 1,000% on their game in this series.
Totally.
Like, it's fantastic. Sometimes
well, days, weeks, months pass.
And everyone's like, well, it is actually this time on this day.
Right.
So, and it's so funny because sometimes it's things I notice and then sometimes it's things that you point out and I'm like, it boggles my mind. I'm like, see, I would never have thought because they managed to put it in there as a detail. And like, you know what? If you've paid attention, you're going to notice this one. And I'm like, that's really great. That's great design.
Emmett gets a second job to support Ted. Again, this relationship is in the fast lane. I guess there's no choice in episodic TV except for it to go fast. But damn, this relationship is going fast.
Yeah. And
they bought a house. Ted went to jail. Now they love each other. Emmett's the breadwinner.
And so then we get, because Ted injures himself at the gym. Somehow.
Paging Dr. Cameron.
He just needs a great chiropractor. And he's like,
we know one.
And now they're trying to get him to take pills.
Well, that was something that I it seemed like something was cut out of the scene because Ted throws his back out at the gym, but then he's in the diner next. But then Emmett has some pills. So I guess they went to the doctor from the
right,
gym.
Right, because it looked like he got prescription.
Yeah, why wouldn't you go? Why wouldn't you take him home?
Put him on his back.
Yeah, lay him down. Give him
on
the pills.
On the floor, yeah, and be done with it. This is that other reference that maybe, I don't think it's obscure, but Emmett says, well, you know what happens from too much pills and liquor?
Did you take your pain pills?
Yes, mother.
Not with that, I hope. You know what comes from too much pills and liquor?
That is a callback from Cabaret, because that's what Sally Bowles is talking about her friend Elsie. It's like, you know what happens from too much pills and liquor?
The day she died, the neighbors came to snicker. Well, that's what comes from too much pills and liquor. But when I saw her laid out like a queen, she was the happiest corpse I'd ever seen.
What does happen?
Well, Elsie's dead.
Oh.
If you listen to the whole song of Cabaret, that she's talking about her had a friend known as Elsie, where they've shared four sorted rooms in Chelsea. She wasn't what you'd call a blushing flower. In fact, she rented by the hour. So,
wasn't Randy Harrison in that production?
Yes, he was. I saw him in that production back in 2016. Yeah, 2016, there was a national tour of the revival that happened, and Randy Harrison played the MC beautifully, by the way. He was fantastic in it.
Did you stage door him?
I did not. I was with my parents, and they were a little in shock from the show.
He's naked in that show, isn't he?
You see his butt very briefly at the end of Act One.
Does he have a swastika on it?
Yes. Yeah. I think I mentioned it in a previous episode. Where the first act ends with him in his trench coat, but he pulls it back to reveal his butt, and there's a swastika on one of his cheeks. I believe it was.
Did you have
right.
orchestra seats for the show?
No, I was in the mezzanine.
Oh well,
but close.
If you had your opera glasses with you, that would have been nice.
Oh no, I was like close in the mezzanine, so I saw very well. but he was very good. Especially because that one is such a high concept cabaret. But yeah, I just love that, as you mentioned, that they'll drop these little nuggets of references. And I'm like, oh, that's what I like.
I thought the part about Emmett being the earner was just a little overdone at first. But then I started to like Ephraim Seeger's treatment of it. If you're used to always being at the forefront in a relationship, it's a big slice of humble pie. When the role is suddenly reversed,
it's almost like a feeling of emasculation.
Yeah, I just didn't think it was quite on the level of Ted having this psychosomatic back problem and then doing pills and liquor at the same time. He could have killed himself.
Right, and it's such an odd juxtaposition, because not two episodes ago he was helping give Emmett the world, and they bought a house. The house he wanted. And I'm like, so now you're down in the dumps because Emmett is shining right now? It confused me.
It does tee it up for what's going to happen to Ted throughout the rest of the season. So I think this was sort of the light beer version of it to kind of warm us up to, oh, Ted's in trouble.
It's the 64 calorie beer here. Yeah.
So hits and misses for this episode. What's your hit?
So I could go with the successful opening that Emmett produced, the razor sharp back and forth between Lindsay and Florinda. I actually really like Hunter entering the story.
Like naked twinks.
I actually really enjoyed this entire episode. I had a lot of fun. And I think it's because that dialogue was just it read so fresh to me compared to some of the previous episodes we've covered. I was just like, I was having fun. I was like having fun during the episode. I was laughing. I was like on the journey. The episode's a hit for me.
Wow. So your hit is the episode.
Yes. Hunt her for love is my hit.
My hit was, of course, the scene of Justin and Brian having makeup sex. Bruce McDonald just killed it there. It was a high point in the filmmaking craft of this series. So I really, really dug what he did there.
And so for my miss, I struggle, but I just decided to go with, there's no Uncle Vic.
Oh, yeah.
Where's he? Where's him and Rodney? What happened? I want to know
more.
Oh,
yeah, that's right. I forgot about that.
So that's my miss. I wanted, because I also feel like Uncle Vic could have offered something to Michael in
the hustler world and
dealing with Hunter. I really do. Yeah. I feel like he would have had an interesting perspective, because especially when they have that diner scene where Deb's there, and so he gives like, well, you could do this, you could do that, and trying to help him. Like, I think Uncle Vic could have offered something as well.
Good father figure.
Yeah.
My miss was Justin and Brian being back together in the first post-Ethan episode. This episode was basically telling us that Justin was wrong to be interested in Ethan, which is not the story that we were told in the previous 10 episodes. The incongruity of the writing really threw me off there. It should have taken much longer for Brian and Justin to get back together. There had to have been more obstructions in that story. It was too easy and too quick.
Like, what an amazing season 3 cliffhanger that could have been.
Yeah, I didn't like the short shrift that Ethan got.
Ethan's yeah, I was too sudden, invested.
Just like David Cameron, Dr. Yes, David Cameron. Yes,
come on.
The problem that I just have with this is Justin calling that an entire mistake, and it was just, I don't know, it wasn't that big of a deal. Justin turns it into the biggest fucking mistake of his life, and you're like, I what? Don't know. So this has been episode 8 of season 3, Hunt for Love.
Next time, Mel and Lindsay quarrel over her long work hours now that she is pregnant.
Woody's is closed down for a minor violation.
Ted sinks into a deep depression.
That will be episode 9 of season 3, and it's called A Big Fucking Mouth.
We're on Twitter and Instagram at StillQueerAF, and you can find us on Facebook at StillQueerAsFolk.
Find me on Instagram at Patrick Randall.
You can find me on Twitter and Instagram at MatthewPD.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed your time with us, please subscribe so that we can keep making shows for you. And until next time, I'm Patrick Randall.
And I'm Matt Dominguez.
Still Queer as Folk was produced by me, Patrick Randall, for Slightly Unbalanced. Matt Dominguez wrote and performed the show with me. Still Queer as Folk is made with love in Chicago.
Still Queer as Folk.